Today's Tesho is case 20 in the Blue Rock collection. Ryuge asks Suibi and Rinzai. Engo's introduction, range after range of mountain peaks, rock faces and cliffs all deliver their profound sermons. If you stop to think, you will be bewildered. Let a man of great strength appear, overturn the great sea, kick over Mount Sumeru, shout and disperse the white clouds, break up the empty sky. With each key and every kill, shut the mouths of all other men. Such a person will be truly incomparable. Has ever such a person been so wonderful? See the following. Main subject. Ryuge asked Suibi, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Suibi said, pass me the chin rest. Ryuge passed the chin rest to Suibi, who took it and hit Ryuge with it. Ryuge said, if you strike me, I will let you. But after all, there is no meaning in Bodhidharma's coming from the West. Ryuge asked Rinzai too, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Rinzai said, pass me the cushion. Ryuge passed the cushion to Rinzai, who took it and hit Ryuge with it. Ryuge said, if you strike me, I will let you. But after all, there is no meaning in Bodhidharma's coming from the West. Secho's verse. Dragon Mountain, the dragon has no eye. Still waters don't impart the ancient way. If the board and cushion don't benefit you, hand them over to me. I have not exhausted this, hence another verse. Even if they are given to me, it's useless. Not for me to sit like a patriarch. Beautiful, the evening clouds, endless, the distant hills, blue upon blue, peak upon peak. Today is the second day of our beautiful August Sesshin. Everybody's been making a wonderful effort in the Zendo. We're lucky, it's cool today, beautiful day, beautiful late summer day, it's just wonderful. Of course, you know, we can find a million reasons not to be happy, not to like it. You know, the other day, somebody said something to me in Dokusan, and I don't think this person will mind if I just mention that the person said something like, I don't know if I like all of this religion. This is too religious for me. And I was stunned, actually, because I never think of this as religion. You know, maybe that's stunning, and it's like, really? How can you not? But I really never think of Zen as religion. And you could say, but you're wearing a robe, but we do bows, so on and so on. And it really got me to thinking, you know, that's true. You know, I guess that's true, but I still don't think of this as a religion. I think this is a special kind of path. I don't know that we really have a word for it. And I think it uses, among other things, the trappings of religion. So it has some religious-like elements. It's true, when we come into the room, we bow to the altar. When you come to your cushion, you bow to your cushion. when you, you know, when we eat, we recite sutras and so on. So many religious-like elements to the Zen practice. But I really don't think that this qualifies as a religion. You know, I have a strong feeling about this because, you know, my feeling is that that religions come from a kind of special revelation. So there's usually a figure who has a revelation and, you know, says, here's how it really is. And then everybody else passes along the word, and you know, gives you it gives you a way to live, an answer, a meaning. And so you know, the history of human beings is history is full of such religions. And usually there are sort of core teachings, and those could be, say, the Ten Commandments, or the Quran, or the Sermon on the Mount. And if you look at Buddhism, it has all of those things as well. You know, so you have the Four Noble Truths, you have the Eightfold Path. You know, those all looks like a religion, you know. Buddhism looks like, you know, a founder, great founder, world-honored one. And so I guess in a certain way, you know, it really is a religion. But maybe it's a religion with a difference or a twist, because there really isn't any fixed teaching or any fixed revelation. If you are familiar with the Four Noble Truths, if you read it in a book somewhere, that's wonderful. Or if you're familiar with the Eightfold Path, that's wonderful. But look out, look out. You know, because I think all of these revelations, all of these visionary revelations have a kind of program or plan, and there's a kind of dream of perfection inherent in them. You know, in the Bible it says, you know, and the lion will lie down with the lamb. This is like beautiful, isn't it? The day will come when the lion and the kid, in the King James Version, the lion and the lamb are going to lie down together in peace. You know, that's such a beautiful ideal. And, you know, also, if you read the Quran, vision of universal brotherhood. And, you know, it seems to me all religions have a kind of vision. And even if we're not religious, you know, we have a kind of a visionary mode of being. You know, so we want experience to take on a certain character or have a certain quality. You know, if you go to the store, you go to Borders Books, the bookstore, you can walk over to the home section. You know, there's a whole section at Borders Books on how to fix up your home. Or if you go over to the magazine section, there's a Architectural Digest, you know. I don't know if you ever look at Architectural Digest, but brilliant architects design homes for people, and they're beautiful, right? Beautiful homes. And there's Metropolitan Home for a younger set, and there's actually a magazine about homes in Florida, and you can look at these beautiful homes. And it's all like a dream, right? This kind of a religious quality to this, right? You know, it's like here's how life should be. Here's how life should be. So, you know, the Bible says, here's how life should be. Quran, here's how life should be. Maybe also Dhammapada says, here's how life should be. And the secular versions of this, right? The vision of, you know, what should a house be like? You know, it should have, I don't know how many thousands of square feet, hello windows, you know, Asian carpets. You come in and it's Thanksgiving and you're a gracious host and the whole family is there. There's no quarreling, everybody gets along, you know, it's beautiful vision. I don't know if there's ever been a Thanksgiving like that. I don't think so. But that's the ideal, right? You know, I've talked about, I think for most people who are into Buddhism, you know, it's not so, it's like Tibet. This is the ideal place, you know, the ideal realm. So, you know, when we think of a place where people are peaceful and good and kind, maybe we think of Tibet, you know. Everybody is interested in meditation, everybody's interested in enlightenment. And it does seem that way. You know, I've met many Tibetans and they're very into this thing, you know. And you look at the beautiful, this fall, we're at the university at Rutgers, we're going to have a special course called the Buddhist Path to acknowledge the Dalai Lama's visit to Rutgers. And I'm one of the teachers of that course, and I've been assembling a slide, actually it's a PowerPoint presentation. And I'm going to be doing stuff on Buddhist art and architecture. So I've been getting together images from, Ajanta and Ellora and Sanchi and in the ruins of Nalanda up to Bamiyan and down to Sri Lanka. And I'm showing like these beautiful, beautiful buildings, you know, these temples. We're going to Tibet and we look at there's all these temples in Tibet. Some of them are on cliff sides. And there's the Podla Palace, very majestic, at the top of a mountain. And you know, then we're going into Thailand, and they have these incredibly crazy designs, you know. And we're looking at some beautiful Chinese temples. Many of them, some of them are almost 2,000 years old. There was a temple, I went to their website and it said, "Happy 1800th anniversary." Wow, that's pretty good, you know. So I'm going to show all of these people these beautiful pictures, and partly what I'm going to be doing is like weaving a spell, right? I'm going to be saying, let's dream collectively of this beautiful world, this beautiful paradise of the Dharma, right? And they'll look at all these buildings and they'll think, you know, what wonderful people must live in such beautiful buildings, you know? And all the monks in there must be very peaceful. They must be very nice and everything must be going very smoothly for them, you know? And indeed, you know, this is the function in a way of monasteries and temples, is to provide this kind of idealization of how things are. If you ever go to a temple or a Zen center, you're likely to find that it's not like that. You know, about maybe 10 years ago, when I, a little more than that, I had always meant to look up Edo Roshi, because he was the Dharma brother of my first teacher, Genki Roshi. And I went up to his temple to meet him, and I sat a few sesshins with him. And he's an interesting person, and I enjoyed the experience. And I had come for one sesshin, and then I went back the following year for another sesshin. And if you know that place, it's a beautiful place. It's millions of dollars went into building it. One of the members of their group was the president of the 3M company. So he gave about $5 million to their sangha. and they built this beautiful Japanese-style temple over this lake. And it's they have like 500 acres or something. So it's very remote, very peaceful. You know, if you drive out there, you would look at the building and say, oh, you know, here the dream is realized. You know, here the vision is made real. This is a Sukhavati. I remember getting there for one session, and I was a little early, so I went for a walk along the lake. And I ran into this Belgian guy, this guy from Belgique. And I said, he had come all the way from Belgium to participate in the session, and he was living there for the ango, for the season. And I said, so how's it going? And he said, terrible. I said, why? He said, oh my God. He said, the people in this temple, they argue, and I feel like I'm losing my mind. What a bunch of unhappy people. And, I tried to put a good face on it, I said, well, temples weren't built for happy people. They were built for unhappy people, and that's actually true, So I, urged him to stick it out. I don't know if he did, but he was really very distressed. But, he was bringing up something that's very important. You know, we have our dreams, we have our vision, and it's beautiful to have a dream, and it's there's a real power to vision. But, you look at the picture of the Potala Palace and it might make you want to sit. You know, when I was in Seattle trying to get through my graduate studies, I had a bulletin board where I gradually filled it up with pictures like the Dalai Lama's temple, a Japanese temple, beautiful Ryutakuji photograph, and Eheiji. Eheiji's beautiful, so a picture of Eheiji and some Chinese temples. And I just look at them and think, they've got it made. And, those were valuable to me. They helped me get through graduate school. And also, I would think, this was before I really started sitting every day at the center. I would think, should I sit today or not? I've got a million things to do. And then I'd look at the picture of Potala Palace and think, okay, I'll sit. And I thought of all those monks and nuns sitting. So, okay, I'll sit. So it inspired me to practice. But, if you go to the Potala Palace, it's not going to be what you might think. There's going to be all these complexities inside the palace. This is very hard for human beings to deal with, because we need the vision. We need the vision, right? But then the vision and the reality come into conflict. And this can be on the grand scale, but it can also be on a small scale. And it's wrenching and troubling. Because, we want so much for the realization of our dreams. And, often the dreams that are connected with something like Zen are our deepest dreams, noblest dreams. And the odd thing is that our love of these things, our worship of these things, creates an iron barrier. It's interesting, we might cling so hard, so rigidly or desperately to our image of perfection, that we can't experience the world for what it really is, And this is the essence of, really the essence of Zen practice is this tension between the vision and the reality. There is such a thing as enlightenment, but as soon as we form a mental image of enlightenment, of the Dalai Lama laughing, always calm, as soon as we do that, we imprison ourselves between two iron mountains. And yet you can say, well, if it weren't for the vision, I wouldn't be here. And that's true, that's the value of the vision. But on the other hand, you know, if you cling too tightly, the real world, the real miracle, the real wonder evades you, you know. So this is tension arises almost automatically in any kind of setting where these vision and reality come together. You know, in this introduction, Engel refers to what he calls ki and kyo. I've talked about this before, but ki and kyo are two different aspects of this tension. So, you know, ki is like a chi, like ki. Like if you have a bow and you're shooting an arrow at a target, you draw the bow taut, and that's a ki. So ki is like pulling the string. When you pull a string, you're creating tension. And the tension grows and grows and grows depending on how hard you pull the string. And then you let the arrow go, and the arrow is going to go where the arrow is going to go. You know what I mean? And you can aim, you can pull hard, and it can fall far short. Or you can pull softly, and you can take your best shot, and it can go straight to the center. Really not in your control. But these are two aspects of practice, ki and kyo. And two aspects of the path we're on. It's like the vision, and our striving for the vision creates a kind of tension. And this tension can build and build and build and build. And then, you know, sometimes it's like something breaks inside of us, or something changes inside of us, and suddenly the problem has disappeared. See, the problem has just disappeared. This is really a very important part of Zen practice. So, you know, if you come to Sesshin and you're working on a koan, maybe you've been working on this koan for several months. Maybe you've been working on the koan for a year or several years. You know, the vision is a triumphal moment in Dokusan, where you come in and you say, "Ah, here it is, you know, blah, blah, blah." And, "Ah, that's it! That's it! You know, my God, that's a fantastic answer." You know. And everybody wants that experience. I mean, you wouldn't even practice Zen if you didn't want that experience. So it's very important to have that noble goal. But, if you worry about passing your koan, or you worry about having a good sit, or you worry about having a beneficial experience, you gum up the works, you know. It's better just to pull the string and shoot the arrow, and see where it goes. This is a really better way to practice. So good practice requires ki and kyo. You could say ki is attention, kyo is letting go. Building tension, letting go. Building tension, letting go. And it is true that effort is required. So if you just decide to spend the session in a chair, that's like little ki, right? Not much is going to be accomplished. Little ki, little kyo. So I'll just sit in a chair for the whole session and, you know, get through it. Great, you know, but not much is going to be done. So if you say, okay, I'm not going to sit in a chair, I'm going to sit on a cushion. And it's hard, and you have a lot of pain in your legs, and you struggle with your back. You have the ideal, you know, which is sitting motionless hour after hour, calm face, immovable body. And you can get mad, because you're not achieving the ideal, or you can get disappointed in yourself. You can beat yourself up. You go through a range of emotions. Really, the best thing is just to try earnestly, and then what happens, happens. You sit on the cushion, you don't sit in the chair, you try to get through the sit. Now, if every time you have pain, you just collapse and say, well, that's it, no pain for me, then not much is going to happen. If you have pain and you begin to work with the breath, use the breath to sweep the pain away, you're going to begin to feel a little better about pain. You're going to go deeper, pain is going to seem less frightening, and at some point you may decide to move, and that's all right. And if you have to move, don't beat yourself up, don't feel anger against yourself. There's a kind of balance between ki and kyo. No ki, no little kyo. More ki, more kyo. But if you set your sights too high, it's going to be disappointing. Right? You're going to go down in flames. If you don't set your sights high enough, also disappointing. Very poor results. So there's a kind of balance here. Finding that's not always so easy. I've been spending a lot of time at this session. This is the second talk where I've been underscoring the importance of no expectations. The Zen tradition is a very dynamic and demanding way of practicing, and we have a teacher. A tradition of teachers who talk all the time about kensho, 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 kensho. And my teacher used to talk about kensho almost every session. And his teacher, Yamamoto Genpo Roshi, used to yell at people if they didn't have kensho. Actually, yeah, I told you, there was that time where Genki Roshi said they had a session, and at the end of the session, Yamamoto Roshi came in and he said, or Genpo Roshi came in and he said, nobody here has had kensho, so guess what? Nobody's leaving. We're having another session. And Genki Roshi used to laugh and say, you can bet people had kensho that time. So part of the tradition is, part of the tradition is this idea of the Great Awakening, the Great Awakening. And part of Zen tradition is to put a lot of pressure, a lot of ki on people. So we do a lot of sitting from dawn till dusk, and we don't move if we can help it. We sit motionless and in intense concentration. And yet, if you do that too rigidly, you're going to come up against an iron wall. There's a way of practicing wholeheartedly and yet not caring about the consequences. This is a hard balance to find, but if you can find it, no matter what you're doing, you're going to feel better about your life. You can sit on the cushion and say, I'm going to have this wonderful, calm sit. And then all of a sudden, something comes up that you didn't anticipate. It could be you suddenly think about your brother and the fact that you haven't really been a good brother, or you begin to think about your fear, maybe something at work is troubling you. And you can say, well, this is not my beautiful sit, this is not my koan. But don't be so sure. Sometimes your big self is sending you a message. It's sending you a hint. And it just seems like this detour. It just seems like this distraction. So, you know, a lot of Zen practice is being open to the moment as it really is. And a part of us really doesn't want to accept this moment. You know, we really don't want to. And by the way, if you have trouble with pain, your real problem is not so much, even though it may seem this way, your real problem with pain is not so much pain. It's our inability to accept pain. Right? So, you know, I'm not criticizing anybody because we've all been in a lot of pain. But, you know, part of what's so horrible about pain is that we can't control it. And it seems infinite. And part of what's so horrible about pain is that it's an assault on our pride. See, we have an image of ourselves as this very lofty being. And then the pain is a very... very trivial, and yet it completely, can knock us right off our feet. And so it's a real blow to our pride. It's like, I don't deserve this. You know, I shouldn't be feeling pain. You know, so, you know, when you feel pain, you know, that's a moment you really have to learn how to accept. And again, I'm not criticizing anybody, but sooner or later, coming to terms with pain is not a matter of being tough or being strong-willed. It's a matter of being able to accept the moment just as it is. See, this, and every koan is really pointing to the moment just as it is. It's our hunger for a vision, hunger for perfection, hunger for Tibet or a Heiji, that doesn't allow us to see it for what it is. So we have to run around in circles for a long time until we bump into it. And that's really what koan training is really about. So, you know, it's important to just make a habit out of accepting this moment, and no matter what it is. You know, and if you can do that, everything's going to be wonderful, whether or not you answer your koan. So, you know, it would be good, actually, if you're anxious about answering your koan, just to say to yourself, I don't care if I answer the koan or not, or I'm not going to answer my koan. I'm just going to go with the koan and see where it takes me. You know, just see where, that's a wonderful way to practice, isn't it? Let's just see where this goes. Let's just see where this goes. And that takes great trust, right? Which is something most people don't have much of. You know, we're so afraid that it's going to take us to our worst place, you know. I mean, what could be worse than practicing Zen for 10 years and having only answered two koans? And like, if you say Zen is important and you say you've been practicing Zen for 10 years and you've answered two koans, that means you're a Zen failure, right? You know, I work in a university where everybody is very goal-oriented and everybody I know feels like a failure. It's so interesting. You know, I have a friend who has written something like 6 books, and he is somebody who's really struggled with his demons, you know. He has he's had very serious drinking problem and depression, and he bangs out a book like every 2 years. And, you know, I don't even think he has 6, I think he has more than 6, you know. And I have another friend who is really a wonderful man. He's not, I don't think, a very good teacher, but he's a good scholar, you know. And he's very highly regarded in our department. And, you know, one day we were having lunch and he sort of confessed to me that he felt like a fraud or a big phony. And I thought, you? But you're the man who wrote the book on your subject, you know. So you know, this is quite, it's quite an illusion to imagine that this is not very widespread, you know. People have this feeling, these dreams, and then they feel they can't live up to their dreams. And this creates very destructive forms of behavior. So, you know, Zen itself could turn into a very destructive practice, actually. You know, this could turn into a very destructive way of life, believe it or not. If you think this is about strength of will, for example, that would be a big mistake and could be very destructive. It would also be a big mistake to think that this is about, being free from problems or being free from difficulties. When we sit on the cushion, every time we do a new koan, we're back in the same crap again. And this is very important. You answer a koan and then I give you another one and you might think, well, this one's going to be easy, right? And then you find yourself right back where you were 10 years ago, maybe, or 3 years ago, groping blindly, right? This is our salvation, you know. Learning how to live that way, groping blindly, is the most wonderful thing in the world. When you grope blindly, you find all kinds of things that you don't understand and that you don't necessarily want. And that's Zen training. But eventually, you know, in Zen, we learn to love what we encounter indiscriminately, you know. And then everything becomes sukhavati. Everything becomes paradise. This is a secret. This is like a wish-fulfilling gem. In the sutras, it's called a wish-fulfilling gem, magical gem. And you say to the magical gem, produce paradise for me. Yeah? And a paradise, however, is not what you think. For you right now, paradise is sitting on your cushion with pain in your legs, sweating, right? And wishing you could focus your mind. And you can say, well, that's not my idea of paradise. It's like, ah, precisely, that's the problem. So please get rid of your idea of paradise and be in paradise. So how do we do this? You know, one of the members of our group wasn't at the sit this last Saturday. She's a regular, and she's always there on Thursday night as well. And she wasn't there on Thursday, and then she wasn't there on Saturday. So I sent her an email, and I said, what's up? And she said, I had a routine medical procedure. And they gave me preparation, which is usually given. It was a kind of, I don't recall what it's called, but before, it's like, when they give you an exam to look at your insides, they might give you like barium or something. It wasn't barium, but it was something like that. And they had asked her to take this substance. Like 24 hours before the exam. And she said what had happened to her was that she had an acute allergic reaction to it and was paralyzed, literally. And her friends came in and found her on the floor and she was trying to move her hands enough to reach the phone. And she was in the hospital for 3 days. And she didn't come to the Monday sit because she had to go back to the doctor and she said she spent hours there doing more tests. You know, this is real life, right? This is, you could say, well, Zen is very artificial, We're all sitting on these cushions and so on and so on. But what we're really doing is preparing for the next moment, whatever it is, you know. And you know, this is her next moment. You know, our next moment is always going to be something we don't expect, something, you know, not necessarily something we want. And you know, the interesting thing was, she wrote me and said how much. She said, I got back from the hospital and I sat down, and she said, I sat for 90 minutes. And she said, when I finished my sit, I felt so wonderful. And of course, I thought, yes, you know, yes, you know, this is what it's all about, right? And this is, so she didn't come home and go, I don't deserve this. You know, why me? So unfair. You know, there's no God. You know, what, you can go through the whole thing. Life is shit, blah, blah, you know, poor me. You know, just, she sat on the cushion, boom. I just felt, it was like all these, she said, I just felt wonderful. She said, I sat down and 90 minutes later, I got up, I couldn't believe it. And this is what we're doing. You know, everything is Buddha. Everything is Sukhavati, the pure land. You know, and you can say it, but as soon as you sit on the cushion, you think, this is not so. The Pure Land is nice, but not if it's 95 degrees. Pure Land is nice, but not if my legs hurt. Pure Land is nice, but not if they're emptying garbage dumpsters all over town and they're interfering with my beautiful, pure morning sit. See, so all of those are karma. All of those are karmic obstacles that we have to give them up. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? It's like the door to paradise is like giving up all your images of paradise. All your hope of paradise is just over, it's thrown over the shoulder. It's like, you know. And then suddenly, strangely, you know, paradise appears. It's 100% guaranteed. You know, if you ask anybody who has answered a koan how she did it, or how, I don't know. You know, I don't know how I did it. You know, you just sit and you say, cuts the cat in two, moo, hot water, cold water, and you at some point you just realize the answer is never going to come. You know? And then something beautiful happens, right? The answer is never, it's like, screw it. You know, it's never going to come. It's so liberating. It's so liberating. You know, I mean, I have been practicing for 30 years. I have Tibetitis too. You know, and I sit on the cushion and I think this is how it should be. And at some point I just say, oh, screw it. You know? And I feel so good. It's like, screw it. God, I'm so happy. So if somebody says, is Buddhism a religion, just say, screw it. Ryuge asked Suibi, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming? See, Bodhidharma's coming, very important. The founding moment of Zen in China, the great Bodhidharma, right? Ryuge asked Suibi, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Suibi said, screw it. Suibi said, he did it a different way, right? He said, pass me the chin rest, will you? No. And of course you know what's coming. A chin rest, by the way, in Zen, A chin rest is so these Zen masters would sit so long that they wouldn't get up for like 8 or 10 hours. And sometimes they didn't want to interrupt their sit, so they would just go to sleep sitting up. They actually used to have in temples a place that you put your chin on it and prop yourself up. Yeah. Hakuin Zenji used to tie himself up. Yeah. Hakuin Zenji used to have a rope over a beam, and he'd put it under his shoulders, and he'd have some kid in the village come at night, and he'd tie it to to the wall so he could stay up all night doing zazen. And that kid would come in the morning and untie him, and then Hakuin Zenji could have breakfast. But please don't think they were trying. See, please don't make the mistake of thinking they were trying. See, it's much more beautiful than that. You know, the cicadas aren't trying. You know what I mean? It's just a natural unfolding of their life. You know, oak tree doesn't try to be an oak tree, just a natural unfolding. It's all about being perfectly natural. Perfectly natural doesn't mean you kick back. It means that you unify yourself with the universe, with your true nature. See? If you're a cicada, that means you just sit there and go all day. Right? If you're a human being, it's more complicated. If you're a Zen practitioner, this is sitting on the cushion till your legs hurt. Ryūge asked Suibi, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West?" Suibi said, "Pass me the chin rest." Ryūge passed it to Suibi, who took it and hit Ryūge with it. Ryūge said, if you strike me, I will let you. After all, there is no meaning in Bodhidharma's coming from the West. Agreeing. Ryūge asked Rinzai too, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West?" Rinzai said, "Pass me the cushion." Ryūge said, "You can strike me if you want, but after all, there is no meaning in Bodhidharma's coming." Bodhidharma wasn't trying to bring Zen to China. He wasn't trying to plant the seed of Dharma. He wasn't trying. See, all of this is makyo, is like illusion. He harmonized himself with his true nature. He was like a cicada, like a katydid, like an oak tree, just naturally did so. Secho's verse, Dragon Mountain, the dragon has no eye. Still waters don't impart the ancient way. See, nobody who lives in the Potala Palace, it's a peaceful day, no problems. Nobody ever achieved enlightenment that way. Awakening is achieved by living in this world, moment to moment, pain in our legs, tired, hungry, whatever, sick, dying, fired, whatever. This is how we wake up. If the board and the cushion don't benefit you, hand them over to me. In other words, I'll hit you with something else. life will hit us with something, but don't think life is your enemy. It's your true, always your true self speaking to you. Even if they are given to me, it's useless. Not for me to sit like the patriarch, like the ideal. Just give it up. Screw it. Beautiful. The evening clouds, endless, the distant hills. Every moment is like blue upon blue, peak upon peak. So it can be like that. It can be like that. But don't try.